Matt Bubala Show here on 720 WGN. We're live from the Allstate Showcase Studios. Actually, we're the Allstate Skyline Studios now from the 18th floor of 303 East Wacker in our new home here for WGN Radio. Thanks so much for staying up late with us, everybody. Whether you're working, hanging out, just can't sleep, whatever it is, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's also the text line, so give us a call. Jump on in if you want to. Here is our very interesting story of the weekend. We saw this a month or two ago, but here's a little bit of the story. This was from the New York Times back in May. It said, the mystery has haunted Canadians for more than a decade. One by one, human feet clad in running shoes have floated ashore on British Columbia's southern coast with gruesome regularity. Last weekend, I remember this was back in May, foot number 14 was discovered by a man strolling on a beach on Gabriola Island, a sleepy and picturesque enclave, population 4,000, that is known for its captivating sandstone and close-knit artistic community. This time, the foot squeezed between a pile of logs wore what appeared to be a hiking boot, according to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. The 13 feet found previously along the coast since 2007 were in running shoes, Adidas, Reebok, and other brands. Each time the question arose, why are the feet ending up in Canada? Where did they come from? And where are the other parts? And that is the unknown. The discoveries have fanned speculation, rational or not, that the unattached feet could be the work of a tsunami, a human trafficker, a mafia hitman, a deranged foot fetishist, or a serial killer who had spread body parts out to sea. Others have theorized that the floating appendages could belong to people falling off a ship or killed in a plane crash. So what in the world is going on? A man who might have a theory that could shed a little light on this for us is Curtis Ebsmeyer. He's a world-renowned oceanographer and a beachcomber, and he joins us on the phone right now. Good morning, Kurt. How are you doing?
Matt, that's a nice intro piece you have.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a weird story, though. I imagine to you it's not that weird, though, because I've read that you said long ago that, you know, the ocean is vastly unknown, that we really don't understand currents and where things end up and how things get in the ocean in the first place. Have you been looking at this type of phenomena, maybe not feet and shoes, but how the ocean currents work and where things end up for a while?
Yeah, I've been looking at it for, like, I don't know, 30 years.
And would you say that in general, when we get surprised by things, we shouldn't be so surprised because that's kind of how currents work?
Well, I think the surprise part comes from the fact that we know so little. If we understood what's really going on, it's no surprise at all. The feet are a good example, and every time I walk a beach in Florida, I find about a shoe every mile, and I collect and I count lefts and rights, and it turns out that certain beaches have an affinity for lefts, and other beaches have an affinity for rights. So that's a pretty formidable question.
Wait, what do you mean? What do you mean? Certain beaches have lefts and certain have rights. You mean feet that wash up on the shore?
These are shoes. These are footwear.
Just that people leave behind, or that you think wash up?
Well, they just wash up. And there's no. These don't have any feet in them. They just wash up. And the question is, how come there's more lefts on one beach and more rights on the other beach? And it turns out that that's the way the winds and the currents face the footwear. So it's a natural phenomenon.
Now, wait a minute. Kurt, you've got to explain that to me. I don't understand how the currents are deciding.
Okay.
Lefts, you go that
off,
way. Right, you stay
take
over
off
here.
Take off your shoes and put them in a bathtub.
Okay.
And then put a fan on them and turn them over so that the fan, you'll find that the fan can't blow in the same orientation on each shoe. So the ocean's winds wind up sorting out as the footwear drifts along. It sorts it out into rights and lefts.
Are you serious? And because of the curve in the shoe?
Yeah, every pair of shoes. Just take off your shoes and look at them while we're talking, and you'll see that if you turn them over as they're look like they're drifting, you can't orient them to the wind in the same way. So it's a natural thing, and you say, well, why in the world would Mother Nature want to have a left and a right in the first place? And it turns out that lots of very primitive sea creatures have left and right differences, and it helps them spread out and increases their chances of survival.
Okay, now you're really blowing me away. But let's go back to the shoes just for a minute, because you still got to explain this to
me.
So that the reason that the ocean is sending a left one way and a right the other way is because of the shape of the shoe, correct? Just the curve of the insole?
It's the shape of the shoe with respect to the wind.
And how the wind affects it. So it'll affect a right different than a left.
Yeah, it's you can actually go and do it yourself. You can count shoes yourself. Very often you'll find this. Now, when you start getting into something a little more esoteric, like a real foot in a shoe, you say, well, how does this happen? And it turns out that it's also a very natural process. If you happen to throw a body in the water and watch it for a while.
Which you have not done, Kurt. We're just going to be clear, right?
I have not done that.
Okay.
But other people have. you've heard of the body farm. I think it's in Kentucky, where they put bodies out on the soil in various environmental conditions, and they watch what happens over time.
Kurt, I have not heard of the body farm. What in the world is that? Are those like with cadavers?
Yeah. It's a very necessary thing to know when you're investigating crime, how a body comes apart.
And so how a body breaks down so that when they find a body that maybe they got to figure out how long has it been out in the elements
exactly.
And things like that?
Wow.
Yeah, it's not unusual to find a body that's been out for years. But you need to know pretty closely how many days, and thus you have the body farm.
So there's literally a body farm in Kentucky where they get cadavers and they put them out in various states of dress and undress, I imagine, and then let them sit through the elements, and they measure how everything decomposes and what happens.
Exactly. There's hundreds and hundreds of bodies out there.
Oh, my gosh. Seriously?
Oh, yeah. Are you on a computer to Google body farm?
I don't know that I want to do that. Oh, my gosh, Kurt. And what do... FBI agents, forensic agents, people like that go here and, like, probably do work and, like, learn how to do this stuff, I imagine?
Yeah, you have experts going out there, and they very carefully take apart a body that's been out there for various lengths of time, and they see what's happening. It's like other experts look at the insects in a body.
Yeah.
It turns out that the insects will lay their eggs and go through various life stages in a very predictable sequence, and that's often used to determine time of death.
Kurt, I'm getting a lot more out of this than I expected. I got to tell you that. I'm learning stuff that I never would have picked up on an episode of CSI, I'm guessing. Well, that is fascinating.
I think what's going on here, we don't have a body farm for drifting bodies.
Maybe they need that. Well, so I was reading some things you've said, and with this foot thing that's floating up in Canada, you've talked about a Nike phenomenon where once Nike invented these certain soles, that maybe that has changed how things float and stay alive in the ocean, right? Or keep floating. Is that part of what could be happening here?
Nike invented, you know, remember the Air Jordans?
Sure.
They invented a gas that they could put into the sole of a shoe to make it more springy.
And thus
the Air Jordan.
Okay, and so that's, and I'm sure everybody copied that. So the reason maybe that so many of these are floating up in running shoes is because if a body ends up in the ocean and eventually it decomposes, things happen, fish, wear and tear, whatever. So limbs, I guess, would start separating as decomposition happens. But these shoes are likely to stay floating, so eventually whatever remained with the shoe would end up on an island somewhere?
That's exactly right. You put it very well. And the trouble... I worked with Nike, and I still do whenever there's a container spill of Nike shoes, because every shoe has a serial number, and I use it to track the ocean currents. That's how I got into the floating world, was Nike told me the code, and they had lost 80,000 shoes back in 1990, and they told me the code, and that was the largest spill of numbered objects ever undertaken in oceanography, so I started looking at container spills.
Well, that's interesting, and to see where that stuff ends up at. So you measure from where it spilled and then see where pieces start floating to shore, and that way you can track how the current worked?
Exactly, and so time went on, and I started working with medical examiners, and they would say, here's where the body wound up. How did the currents take it there? And I wrote, scientific journal articles on how bodies drifted in the water, and that was a first. So I said, well, okay, how does this really work? And the medical examiners would tell me that human bodies, when they come apart, usually disarticulate, which means they come apart at the joints. So you put it very well about the sneakers. You look at your feet and you say, well, where's the big joint? And that would be the ankle. And the foot just fits in the shoe. And when decomposing goings on, the gases, it caused the foot to expand and wedge itself in the shoe. So when the foot comes off, all you really have left on a body is the foot in a shoe, because there isn't any other flotation device that we usually wear.
That's so fascinating. Now, I read that you've said, so the tsunami in Japan, that was how many years ago now?
2003. So it's been a while, but I was expecting, given all the the tens of thousands of people that were lost, I was expecting feet in sneakers. And so I urge people, if you see a sneaker on the beach and you see bones in it, do not leave it, because the ocean will take it away.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be the only remains that a family has of a loved one. So one thing about the ocean is, if you see it on the beach, and you try to come back and find it again, it's likely not to be there, because the ocean's always moving things around.
And so but feet have never really started washing up from the tsunami like you expected, right? And now it's
not that I have reported to me. So I'm still puzzled by that. I would guess it happened, but it's not unusual for, if you watch the news very carefully, it's not unusual for feet to wash up in shoes.
Well, and I imagine we don't hear about that much in Chicago, because we're not on any of the coasts, where I guess it would happen more often, probably, right? Why do we not hear about that here off Lake Michigan?
I would guess that quite a few wash around Lake Michigan. It's just the police don't like to report it, because there's a lot of
freaks people out.
ghoulish people out there that the police don't want to be bothered by people who really don't know anything.
Yeah.
So I would guess Lake Michigan has quite a few.
How many bodies do you estimate are floating in the oceans of the world at any one time?
Well, let's see. Let's go back to British Columbia. I was doing some work there, and I learned that there's back 10 years ago, there was 2,400 people officially listed as missing. So you say, well, where are they? Well, some are going to be in the water, and some of those are going to be feet that wash up. So you're talking about a lot of missing people.
Well,
and most of those missing people are not criminals, so they aren't in the DNA databases.
Let's talk about, so now here's something that's fascinated me for, I think, 5 years now. MH370, the Malaysian Airlines plane that disappeared over radar and we believe flew until it ran out of gas and crashed in the ocean somewhere off of Australia. And the search actually was finally officially concluded. There was reports about a year ago about finding a couple of plane parts, but then nothing more ever happened. How is that possible?
Well, if you... I tracked the MH370 I had five reports of different parts of the aircraft. They were all on the right-hand side of the plane. I have not seen a detailed forensic analysis of those plane parts, but when you laid them out on a map of currents across the Indian Ocean, they followed a very predictable pattern, of well-known pattern of currents that run from off Australia over to South Africa. And so the five pieces of the aircraft were distributed roughly across the Indian Ocean in a very, very, very predictable way. And the last piece that was reported was in South Africa. And lots of objects have been released to steady currents off South Africa, and in about 2 years, quite a few of them have arrived up in Florida. So I'm expecting MH370 parts in Florida.
Really? But why haven't we seen any body parts? Why aren't there any shoes?
Well, that's a good question. Now, if you subscribe to the theory that the plane went down in deep water, like 15,000 feet, which would be a typical depth in the Indian Ocean, what happens is when something goes to that depth, it gets compressed into a very solid object. I have mannequin heads that have been lowered down 15,000 feet. In fact, I'm looking at one right here as we speak. That was brought back, and it's about 2 inches tall. Originally, it was a wig head that was about a foot tall, but it's rock solid. So
because it got crushed down by the pressure?
Yeah, by the pressure just makes it rock solid. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if the MH370, if it went down in that kind of pressure, shoes would have been compressed from a foot long, no pun intended, just a foot long, they would have been compressed down to about an inch or two long and may not have float. So when you put that kind of pressure on an object, it changes the density of that object and its ability to float. So I don't think we know the answer to that.
So for that to happen, our assumption would have to be the plane somewhat stayed together then. It didn't, you know, disintegrate as it hit the ocean, because then bodies would have been scattered everywhere and they wouldn't have necessarily floated down. With your theory there, we're assuming the plane stayed mostly intact and then floated down, you know, sunk down in the ocean.
Well, I kind of wonder about that, because the parts of the plane came from the right side, and it suggests that the plane came apart to a certain extent. I don't think we're going to know, but the behavior of human bodies in the water, particularly at high pressure, I think is virtually unknown.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's fascinating. So are you surprised that more of the plane hasn't washed up then?
Yeah, I am. I'm really very surprised, because the pieces that have been reported are kind of, you know, fairly large, but I haven't seen a detailed forensic analysis of those pieces. So I think there's a lot more to be learned, and I'm sure the investigators continue to puzzle over those pieces. So you might recall back to the Titanic, how long it took just to find the wreckage from the Titanic. That was 1912.
Well, but we didn't have the technology that we have now. I mean, I understand it is a vast ocean. We're not, you know, we probably can't truly grasp how big of an area we're really talking about the search being and the depth of the water there, right?
Exactly. I've watched, you know, like we all did, a lot of the searches going on, and it's such a vast ocean. I've spent 4 years in the ocean just looking for things, and it's really, really so. It's almost beyond comprehension how big the ocean is. And when you sit in a media studio and look at film, you just don't get the feeling if you're actually out there looking for things, it is really, really tough.
Yeah, I can imagine. Kurt Ebsmeyer is a world-renowned oceanographer and a beachcomber. When they say you're a beachcomber, do you just love walking on beaches all over the world, or are you always looking to see what washed up on shore?
No, I beachcomb the internet. I have a newsletter. I wrote a book, and I continue. People are always telling me, "Kurt, you know about this?" And the answer is usually no, because there's so much to be learned. So I encourage people to email me with things they see, questions they have, because there's really no stupid question. Just questions are just. Almost every question will lead to a PhD after just a few sentences of thought.
Huh. So, Kurt, well, how can people find you on the internet? Where should they go?
If you want to find me, just go just Google my name, Ebsmeyer, Ebsmeyer, and you can find me at The Floating World. And there's a book there on The Floating World, and I wrote about everything from pharaohs to Vikings to how Columbus really did discover America with flotsam and things like that.
Interesting. Is the book called The Floating World?
It's called Flotsametrics. It's a new word I invented. F-L-O-T-S-A Metrics, Flotsam Metrics. And I figured we needed a word for the face of the ocean because it turns out that it's virtually unexplored.
Yeah.
Economics is not the only dismal science. I would put oceanography there, too.
Kurt Ebesmeyer, the author of Flotsam Metrics, and that's available online. And search him, Google him, and you can find more. Kurt, we'll check in with you again. We really appreciate your time tonight.
Well, thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you. We'll talk to you again. Well, that is interesting. Flotsam Metrics. Flotsam Metrics. That's a new word for you. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll do the news coming up here in a little bit. Matt Bubala with you on 720 WGN.